Hi, it's Tom here. And before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just want to tell you all about a really exciting event that we have coming up. In October, we'll be doing a special live episode of The Brendan O'Neill Show. Brendan will be joined on stage by the legendary Rod Liddell. You will not want to miss this. It's part of an event called Podcast Live, which is on the 5th of October between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. in London. Tickets are now available at podcastlive.com. There are two types of tickets. You can buy tickets for just the Brendan O'Neill Show, or you can buy an all-day ticket, which includes access to all the other podcasts at Podcast Live. Whichever ticket you choose, whether it's an all-day or a single show, when you go to podcastlive.com, make sure you click the link below the Brendan O'Neill Show logo, as that's the only way you can guarantee a seat for our podcast. So that's the Brendan O'Neill Show with Rod Liddell at Podcast Live on the 5th of October. Don't miss it. Now, on with Last Orders. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. This is a show where myself and the IEA's Chris Snowden discuss the latest in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. In this episode, we're joined by IEA Director General Mark Littlewood to discuss the government's mad plan to meddle in the food supply, the American moral panic against vaping, and the ban on gender stereotypes in adverts. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, Spiked's Nanny State podcast. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the IEA's Director of Lifestyle Economics, Chris Snowden. Hello,
hi.
Chris.
Hi, Tom.
And today we're delighted to be joined by the IEA's Director General, Mark Littlewood.
Hi, Tom.
So, to kick things off, let's talk about the government's mad plan to control the food supply. So this is Public Health England's flagship food reformulation policy. It's something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, but it is so crazy. It definitely deserves its own segment. So to those who might not know, this is basically the scheme whereby the government is instructing the food industry to remove 20% of calories from food. It is, as Josie Appleton argues in a new report for the IEA, the largest extension of state control over the British diet since rationing. And it also seems on many levels to be quite a hilariously ignorant and inept scheme in many respects. Josie's report includes examples of PHE demanding that sugar be removed from products made almost entirely of sugar, things like boiled sweets. So loads of crazy examples like that. Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit more about this scheme? Just give us a sense of the kind of scale of it.
Oh, the scale is tremendously large. And it's so insane that I think a lot of people just don't believe that it can be happening insofar as they've heard about it at all. When Josie did her excellent report, we got quite a lot of media coverage. And it was clear to me that a lot of people had no idea this was underway. I mean, where do you begin with it, really? The report was based on quite a lot of documents never been seen before. She used some Freedom of Information requests, getting emails, particularly interesting ones, I thought, between Action on Sugar and Public Health England. And it really shows the sway of the most extreme pressure groups. I mean, Action on Sugar is basically a guy called Graham McGregor, who probably even he would admit is a fanatic. And about two other people, you know, but they have an immense amount of influence. They are one and the same with Action on Salt. In fact, they began as Action on Salt. Now they're Consensus Action on Salt and Sugar. And we'll probably move on to fat.
Working their way through the entire periodic
table.
Well,
they are, in all seriousness, going on a lot about fat at the moment. Graham McGregor was recently complaining there's too much focus on sugar and we should be looking at fat. It's like, well, whose fault's that, you know? And his tone in some of these emails is really one of, you know, him being the master and Public Health England being the servant, just bossing them around. Remarkable stuff, saying, you know, ignore the Food and Drink Federation, ignore the public even. The scale and complexity is quite difficult to get across, even in a lengthy report. But one of the problems with it is a very, very simplistic idea in which you look at the population as if it's one person, the classic public health approach, and you say, well, the population is consuming, on average, 10% too many calories. Therefore, rather than try and get people to change their diet, which is really hard to do, we will just get the food industry to take 20% of the calories out of the food. Brilliant idea. You know, why has no one thought of this before? And then people will lose weight. Now, this, of course, takes no account of the fact that there isn't such a thing as an average person. There are a lot of people who are struggling to get enough to eat. There are people with eating disorders and all sorts. It's very far from being a targeted intervention, nor does it take into account that people are free agents and they will respond in ways that the state does not expect them to. As Adam Smith pointed out 250 years ago, individuals have a momentum of their own. But they don't even really understand the food manufacturing system. So they just, everything's based on averages. So they will take, for example, the category of sweets. Now, the idea that you should take sugar out of sweets is in itself ridiculous because that is what they consist of. You know? And if you're trying to lose weight, just don't eat sweets. That is perfectly reasonable advice. What they do is they take an average sugar content of sweet, a category they call sweets, which actually varies enormously from boiled sweets, which are basically all sugar, and something that contains nuts, and you know, that will obviously contain a lot less sugar, and they average it out and say, well, the average is, let's, I don't know what they say, but 70% sugar. We want to take that down to 50% sugar. Well, you can't have a boiled sweet that's 50% sugar. You can't put anything else in these products. It's just bizarre, and their ignorance of food and cooking in general is very apparent. For example, they tried to pressure the food companies into reducing the amount of sugar in jam, and the food companies had to point out to them that there has to be 50% sugar in jam, otherwise it cannot legally be called jam, and also it will go off. And then public health England go, okay, we know that we'll exempt that. So there's loads of ad hoc exemptions to this as public health England kind of face reality. But the consequence for consumers, well, it's quite hard to tell. We've already seen that the consequence in a lot of categories has been simply shrinking the product. It's the only thing that you can do, particularly with things like confectionery. With other products which don't come in single servings, you know, cereals, for example, ketchup, mayonnaise, all of which is part of this food reformulation package. I don't know what they're going to do. I just don't think they'll be able to do anything. They just have to kick the can down the road. And then in 5 years' time, when these targets are supposed to be met, we will see what the government does. Hopefully the government will say, this is a mad idea. Why do we ever do it? But it's possible that they might try and legislate.
But help me with this, if you could. What actual sort of units are going to be measured? So let's take the case of boiled sweets, right? I could understand them saying, whatever, you need to dial down the sugar content. I wouldn't approve of it. But what will be the legal unit? I mean, supposing I want to buy boiled sweets in future, will manufacturers just have to sell me 25 boiled sweets in a massive bag full of rice? Because then in total, if you look at the product I've actually bought, there isn't much sugar in it, because, and I just throw away the rice. I mean, what's the actual unit that they're measuring?
Generally speaking, it's per 100 grams, so you can't.
So you just buy your boiled sweets like with rice?
Well, that is a possible solution.
I think he's cracked it now.
Originally, the plan was very simplistic. It was that we're going to reformulate everything. The food industry only put salt and sugar and fat in these products for the laugh, and they can easily replace it with protein and, you know, air and artificial sweeteners. But once it was explained to them that you simply cannot do that with something like a Mars bar, Public Health England capitulated a bit and said, okay, we'll let you off if it's kind of single use. You can shrink your Mars bar. Indeed, that's exactly what's happened. But it still leads.
I thought that was Brexit's fault.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, these food companies have been using Brexit as an excuse, and they've also been saying, oh, the price of cocoa and sugar has gone up. Actually, last I checked, price of cocoa and sugar was one of the lowest levels for years. And when the Office for National Statistics looked at this shrinkflation phenomenon, they did find it was quite a general phenomenon. It happens in a lot of markets, but they found it happens particularly in the food industry and particularly for sugary food. They didn't, unfortunately, draw the conclusion that this is because the government has been telling these companies to take sugar out of products, but that is clearly what's been going on.
Do you think, Mark, that Public Health England have just kind of overplayed their hand on this a little bit? Because this is so huge, it's so crazy, and they're also now met with an administration, although who knows how long Boris Johnson's government will be intact. It might have gone by the time you listen to this podcast. This plan is so large, as Joseph was saying in the report, you know, the largest intervention in the food markets is rationing. But, you know, have they just pushed it that little bit too far?
Well, one almost hopes so. I mean, I think Chris and I have spent the last 5 or 10 years confidently waiting for some massive public backlash that never actually appears to come. I mean, the phlegmatic nature of the British consumer is astonishing, really. So I don't know. I expected there to be more of a rebellion against, say, the sugar tax. I expected there to be much more of a rebellion against the smoking ban. But actually, we do seem to be an incredibly compliant bunch. So I think it's more likely to be tackled at a political ideological level. if you have a government that says, please, 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 please just make this stop. We're not going to indulge this nonsense anymore. Then we've got a chance of that. Certainly, if this administration were to survive, the early indications are that they are unenthused about nanny state interventions. But I despair a bit of the unradical, unrevolutionary character of the average British consumer. I mean, what will it take for people to actually say, with this up, I will not put, I'm only going to vote for politicians that will take a more liberal attitude towards this? And I guess it sort of comes in and people complain about it afterwards, by which time it's sort of bit too late, or people just adapt. But I must admit, on this one, I am mystified. I mean, I obviously gave an extreme example about boiled sweets being sold with rice to get around it, but other than cost, I'm trying to work out what the actual consequence would be on somebody's diet. I mean, the shrinkflation thing, okay, maybe that means I'm ripped off. But, I mean, I don't eat Mars bars individually. I buy them in a pack of – I buy about three packs of 10, and I keep eating them until I'm full. I don't really care whether that's one Mars bar, two and a half, or three. I mean, it's pointless. You know, it changes the packaging, it might change the price somewhat, but I'm not overly price sensitive. Will this actually change anything? I mean, is food going to taste disgusting if people go down this route? Or is this just grandstanding and actually everybody's diet will remain exactly the same? It's just we'll be buying our food in slightly weird-shaped packages in order to get around the regulations.
Well, a bit of both. Clearly, the packaging and the sizes are changing. I didn't realise you were such a fan of Mars bars, Mark. I have to say. So, yeah, people have noticed the Easter eggs getting smaller. I mean, every year or every few months, a Sun or somebody will do a report. The Toblerone thing was the most ridiculous example, right? And they've since gone back on that and given you a full Toblerone. But no one's really joining the dots. No one's connecting this with Public Health England.
They're blaming the companies.
Well, they're blaming the companies. They think it's exploitation, shrinkflation, and the companies are then saying, oh, this is Brexit and the price of raw materials. So no one's been particularly honest about this. And the Public Health England scheme is known internally as health by stealth. The whole point of this is you keep it as quiet as possible. And this is why we've had to use the Freedom of Information Act for stuff that really should be public knowledge. Yeah.
And this week, although it'll probably be last week by the time people listen to this, there was this suggestion put out that there was going to be a snack tax. So, Chris, do you want to tell us a little bit about this? How does this fit into this whole landscape of food reformulation and all the rest of it?
It's the obvious and predictable next slide down the slippery slope, perfectly predictable consequence of bringing in a sugar tax. My main objection to the sugar tax all along, really, was that this cracks open the door to more extensive taxation of the food and soft drink supply. And this study in the BMJ is more or less a carbon copy of the study that was published some years ago, modelling the effects of a 20% tax on sugary drinks. That was supposed to reduce obesity by 1.5% or so. This one says it's going to be even better. It's going to be even more effective than sugar tax. It's going to reduce obesity by 2.7 percentage points, which first off makes you wonder why, if these people are such experts, they didn't come up with a snack tax first. And of course, the answer is it was politically easier to go after sugary drinks. And once you've set that precedent, then you can go after everything else. If this happens, which who knows? I mean, under Boris Johnson, I suspect it probably won't, but it'll happen somewhere in the world. In fact, it has. There are a few countries that already tax snacks, and they're still fat, incidentally. places like Hungary. I mean, Hungary is actually the fattest country in Western Europe. People often say it's Britain. It's not. And they've got a slew of taxes and all sorts of things. If this happens, it would just be something else. You know, do you really think that if obesity falls from 28% to 25%, which is what they predict, which won't happen, by the way, because these models are for the birds, complete fantasy stuff, do you think they'll stop at 25%? Will they be happy? Is 25% a tolerable amount of obesity?
Help me with this again. Sorry, I'm being a bit of a pedant, but what is the definition of a snack? I mean, on measuring these things, I get what, I understand what sugar is. It has a, formation, and you can work out what proportion of a drink is made up of sugar, and you can thereby tax it accordingly if you wish to. I don't think we should, but I at least understand the measurement. What the hell is the legal definition of a snack as opposed to other foodstuffs that are non-snacks?
To be fair, it's not, they don't actually say snacks as such. They are sugary snacks, really. So chocolate bars, biscuits, I think cakes are in there. So that kind of thing, to go after the sugary stuff first. But obviously the next step would be crisps and so on. Of course, most of these things are already taxed at 20%. Let's not forget, fruit and veg is zero rated and extremely cheap. Most snacks, you've got to pay VAT on them. There are obviously weird exceptions to that. The Jaffa cake
Is that right?
Ongoing legal case with
Food was VAT exempt. No.
I mean, crisps, you pay VAT on. The whole thing with the pasty tax was about exemptions for VAT. And the ongoing case, I think it's maybe not ongoing anymore, but it went on for a long time, about Jaffa cakes, in which the Jaffa cake company insisted that they were cakes which are not. Or maybe they said they were biscuits, weirdly enough. One of the two. Yeah. They had to claim they were one of the two, and it went to the High Court in the end. And Jaffa Cakes won, I think, so you don't pay VAT on Jaffa Cakes. But would any, you know, would people eat fewer Jaffa Cakes if you did pay VAT on them? I mean, maybe on the margins there might be some difference. Biscuits are incredibly cheap anyway. I really can't see a 20% tax making any meaningful difference.
But it's just, it's relentless, isn't it? I mean, you say there's no end in sight. And the supposed beneficial results of these policies, A, don't emerge, and then nobody's held responsible for them. It's just, let's go again with another plan. Yeah. It's a bizarre, almost form of virtue signalling industry. It's, you know, I'd have more sympathy for it if it was proven to work. I mean, I would still be ideologically on the liberal side of the spectrum. People want to eat large amounts of stuff and get fat. That's sort of up to them, according to my ideology. But what's maddening about it is it is ineffective. And it's just this bizarre industry of producing wacko ideas as some sort of enormous act of virtue signalling rather than actually tackling public health.
And you wouldn't get away with it in other areas of healthcare. That's the thing, or in the other areas of health. I mean, public health people, I don't consider them to be really public health people anyway, but they're very keen to not portray themselves as paternalists or killjoys or anything like that. They're very keen to you know, present themselves as a wing of medicine. But in medicine, you would never get away with just trying something out, hoping it works and it not working, and be allowed to continue, you know, taking out organs for no reason.
And insist that something far more extreme and invasive is now necessary.
On a patient that's not consenting. That's the other thing, right? You know, in medicine, you require the consent of the patient. Public health people don't require any consent from anyone other than a few dozy politicians.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's move on to our next topic, and that's, are e-cigarettes actually far more deadly than we thought? So last month it was reported in the US that six people in Illinois had been hospitalized with vaping-related breathing problems, according to health officials in the US. One sadly died, and this was quickly held up by the US authorities as the first death by vaping on record. So the Center for Disease Control leapt on this as proof of the serious risks associated with e-cigarettes. Apparently the Food and Drug Administration have already for some time been investigating Juul, the most popular US e-cig, over a handful of reported cases of Juul users having seizures. And this is, of course, against the backdrop of something we talked about a bit on this podcast, which is the panic over vaping in the US, particularly around young people. So, Chris, can you tell us a little bit more about these cases? Are these finally the kind of unknown health effects of vaping actually coming to the surface, or is something else going on?
This is the vaping moral panic of the USA finally really coming to a head. I think we've talked about the huge difference between the UK approach and the USA approach before on the podcast, with the health agencies in Britain being pretty sound on this and the ones in America being absolutely mental. And they've been spreading fear for a long time. The appearance of Juul as a really popular product, I gather, takes 70% of the market now in America, has led to what can only describe as a moral panic. I don't like to use that term too liberally, but it really has all the makings of it. And these recent events certainly have the makings of it. What seems to have happened, and the truth is not fully emerged by any means, is that six individuals in Illinois were vaping black market THC. THC is the active ingredient in cannabis, in case you don't know, and were hospitalized with something or other. It's not clear what, but certainly some kind of lung condition. And one of them died, as you say. Since that happened, there have been, I think, now over 200 reports of people in some way coming to some kind of undefined harm from vaping across 22 states. Now, it's possible that some of these people are also vaping black market drugs, but it seems more like people are just getting on a certain bandwagon. You can report these cases online on the FDA website, so it's not as if some clinician has examined these people. I suspect that the majority of them are either false or hugely exaggerated, but it has caught fire in America. It was a kind of tinderbox waiting for the match, and this death, which is now being portrayed as being the world's first vaping death, is not being portrayed as the world's first, you know, black market THC vaping death. It's been mixed up and deliberately blurred with vaping per se. And the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, all the anti-smoking groups have always been against vaping, have been extremely misleading in the way they've reported this as just a vaping death, and are doing everything they can to put smokers off from switching to e-cigarettes. The truth, eventually, I think, will get its shoes on. We'll find out what's gone on in this case. And I suspect it will be nothing more than an isolated instance, really, of some people vaping something they shouldn't be vaping. But it really has caught on in America, this whole panic. Michigan has just banned flavored e-cigarettes, partly off the back of this. San Francisco, as we mentioned a month or two ago, has banned e-cigarettes outright. There are a lot of people now think that vaping is more dangerous than smoking.
Well, I mean, the moral panic may be spreading here a little bit as well. This is anecdote, not data. I was going to say I've given up cigarettes. I'm not sure, having been off cigarettes for just over a week. But I said to my doctor, look, I'm going to throw every nicotine replacement thing at this. I'm going to use e-cigarettes. I'm going to use heat not burn. I'm going to use patches. He said, I wouldn't use e-cigarettes. Someone's just died in America.
Oh, really?
And I was, I'm really not going to base my long-term health decisions on one small incident in America. I mean, I'm no medic. I don't know whether there might be some long-term effects of vaping. But surely, to God, they're minimal compared to the risks that I would be incurring if I continued to smoke combustible cigarettes. So it's bizarre that there is this. I mean, you've already pointed out, Chris, that it sort of seems to be more black market activity, not the sort of regulated white market. But even if there were some potentially fatal consequences of vaping, I would need to be persuaded that those risks were on about the same level as cigarettes in order not to move one from the other. And there's absolutely, one incident, one swallow does not a summer make, right? Mm. I mean, the number of people who are dying as diseases related to combustible cigarettes is a very, very meaningfully large number.
Not in their teens, to be fair. And I think makes it dramatically more scary when it's basically healthy young men suddenly dropping dead, apparently.
Because that's at the heart of this, isn't it? Is that in the US, there's this idea that Juul in particular is just sort of all these young people who might not have even ever took up cigarettes are suddenly vaping.
Now on nicotine.
Yeah, having seizures. This was the thing. In the weeks leading up to this incident, there were more and more reports about people having seizures, which as far as I could tell were totally made up. Or they were people who had epilepsy or something, you happen to also have.
I mean, it's the sign that it's a moral panic that this is being reported in the United States of America, but apparently is not occurring in other jurisdictions where the same consumption habits prevail.
Well, this is it. And it kind of shows how it's a very insular mentality, really, for Americans, because we have, in this country, probably the highest vaping rate in the world. We've never had any reports of seizures, let alone deaths. And the Americans seem to be kind of ignoring that and focusing on supposed 200 people who've had some undisclosed health problems.
So where does this come from then? Because it can't just be off the back of these handfuls of cases like we're talking about. What really kind of spurred on this bizarre, it's not even double standards the right word, but it was fascinating again talking about that San Francisco example a couple of weeks ago. You know, the mayor giving this big impassioned speech about how terrible tobacco is and therefore you should ban e-cigarettes. You think if you're that bothered about it, you'd ban cigarettes, surely, and sort of thing I can imagine San Francisco doing. But nevertheless, where does this come from? Why do, on the state level or even on the federal level, is there this obsession with it? Is there any sense of where all that comes from?
It's a perfect storm, really. The anti-smoking groups and the anti-smoking academics have always been dead against e-cigarettes. Juul has become, from what I can tell, a genuine youth phenomenon in a way that e-cigarettes haven't. So in the UK, the likes of Ash, who are still pro-vaping, Action on Smoking Health, they can legitimately point to very, very low use of e-cigarettes by non-smokers and by kids. In America, it seems that you can't. That actually there is a very large number of high school kids using Juul in particular. So it's not as if this moral panic is based on nothing whatsoever. There are certain statistics that kind of encourage it. In addition, a few months ago, Philip Morris bought 25% stake in Juul. So now they're the bad guys. And it's kind of the culmination of years of anti-vaping hysteria, really.
Very strange to see that in the States, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You would think, you know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, predict which countries will take a draconian line on e-cigarettes, the United States of America would not be in my top 50. Really, really extraordinary. Am I right, though, that it's that federal regulation is pretty lax? So there's going to be state-by-state different differences. I think you were mentioning San Francisco, outright ban on it. But then the interesting thing in the States is you will be able to compare state with state. I mean, if, you know, we will quickly see whether the population of San Francisco get healthier than the population of Alabama or some other state that hasn't banned it.
I think, like, heroin's more their problem in San Francisco at this point.
Yes, right. Yeah. Amongst other
things, yeah. We went into this last month.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So let's move on to our final topic. So recently, TV ads for Philadelphia cheese and Volkswagen are among the first to be banned under a new UK gender stereotyping rule that was introduced by the Advertising Standards Authority. They recently banned what they called harmful gender stereotypes from advertising. Interesting to look at the ads themselves. The Philadelphia ad showed two hapless fathers leaving a baby on a restaurant conveyor belt. And then the VW ad showed, among other things, a woman with a pram. The first ad got a whopping 128 complaints, suggesting that it was perpetuating harmful stereotypes about men being incapable of looking after children. That's why that one got nixed. And a mighty three people complained about the VW ad. But despite that, you know, despite the fact that barely anyone seems to have actually cared about these things, they've still been banned. Nonetheless, Chris, it's not strictly a kind of public health story, but pretty mad one nonetheless. What do you make of all this stuff?
Well, it's censorship. I mean, it's related to public health insofar as it's always public health people trying to stop things being advertised because they think it has a bad influence on people. These gender stereotype regulations were, I think, always going to end in tears. I really recommend people get on YouTube and look at these ads. Perhaps that was the idea, get a bit of viral marketing going. There's probably more people seeing that Volkswagen ad than would have seen it at the time. It's actually a really boring advert. It's trying to be quite woke. They went out of their way, I think, to make it. So to describe it briefly, it starts off with a man and a woman in a tent. The camera zooms back and you see that this tent is halfway up a scary-looking mountain. Then there's two blokes who are astronauts floating around in space or inside a spacecraft. And then you go to a guy with, I think, one leg. He's disabled in some way doing a pole vault or something, I think. And then it cuts to a woman reading a textbook, presumably studying for something, with her baby in a pram by her side, and this electric Volkswagen car drives by. And I'm not quite sure what it's trying to say. I mean, I guess it's trying to say that the electric car is quiet so it doesn't wake up the baby. But it's just the general kind of awful advert you get from these bloody companies these days, which is just not very specific about anything, but just general about, you know, reach for the stars.
What is the definition of a harmful gender stereo?
Well, in this instance, it's a woman being shown with a baby.
But because what is the stereotype that's perpetrating that some women have babies?
Yeah, apparently
that's a dangerous stereotype.
Well, the complaint is that the men are the astronauts and the parent is the woman. I mean, that's how lame it is, which is why I only got three complaints, because you'd have to be really weird in the head to think that's offensive. But if you can't do that, what can you do? I don't think that is gender stereotyping. I think that the thing with the blokes being useless at looking after babies is gender stereotyping, but I don't care. I think you need to have stereotypes in adverts. They're only 30 seconds long. You can't subvert every stereotype. If you had that at the end, if it was a man with a textbook with a baby by the side, people were going, what's the symbolism of being a man? You can't start throwing these confusing aspects at people. You do need to have stereotypes because you're trying to create characters in a few seconds.
But what is the supposed harm? I mean, supposing an advertiser said, "Yes, we readily conceive that this advert is full of gender prejudice and is wholly inaccurate and blah blah blah." So, so what? Who's imagined to suffer as a consequence? Well, it may be an unsuccessful advertising campaign, but I'm trying to work out how many nervous breakdowns have there been as a consequence of a woman being pictured sitting next to a pram. I mean, none, surely.
According to the ASA, their exact wording when they brought this ban in was that these portrayals could play a part in, quote, limiting people's potential.
Oh, God.
So it shows what they think about people there. It's funny, we were talking about this not necessarily being linked to public health, but I looked up some of the ASA's greatest hits even before this kind of came in. There were two that kind of struck me. There was one in 2008 where there was an Oasis advert, the fruit drink, and the slogan was "for people who don't like water." And that was banned because it was deemed to potentially, quote, discourage good dietary practice, which is quite funny. And then there was another one similarly in 2014 where it banned an ad for Morrison's. It showed a little girl taking the salad out of her hamburger before eating it. And apparently that was banned on the grounds that it disparaged healthy eating as well. So there is a bit of a crossover between these two things. But Chris, talk about advertising. And this is a bit of a link with what we normally talk about. It's interesting that it's always the advertising that's the kind of first thing to go after. Is that always the kind of way with a lot of other public health stuff as well? It's always about, you know, the cigarette advertising before moving on to the smoking ban, etc. Is that something that you can always almost see the pattern there?
Yeah, always, because advertising hasn't got very many friends. People find advertising at best a necessary evil. They find it annoying, and indeed that Volkswagen advert is annoying. they often don't associate it with all the free stuff that they get in return. And if they did, maybe they'd value it a little bit more. And for the nanny statists, the great phrase that was used by Arthur Seldon and Ralph Harris in one of the first ever IEA books in the 50s was that these people go after the reflected image of the thing they love. You know, they can't get rid of the thing itself, but they can get rid of its reflected image.
But I'm trying to work out what's the slippery slope here. I mean, it's insane that we're banning television adverts on an apparent basis that we portray a young mother with a pram. But I mean, what's the next step? We actually ban young mothers from having a pram? I mean, what I'm trying to work out.
They shouldn't be allowed out, Mark. No, that's the only way. Well,
they're perpetuating a gender stereotype. The advert, there's a young woman like pushing a pram down the street.
What they should have done, what they should do now in order to satisfy these people, they should start off with two women in a tent at the side of a cliff, and then two women in a spacecraft, and then a woman pole vaulting, and at the end, just a baby on the side of the road in a pram on its own.
It's quite a bleak image. Yeah. But it's interesting to say about advertising, and it's, you know, because what was interesting, whether it was sincere or not, was that the company behind the Philadelphia ad tried to make the argument that actually they were trying to do something dead progressive, because the whole point was that this ad was showing that, you know, it's not just women who look after babies, and that could have been a woman, whatever. But it is interesting, like, in terms of the slippery slope on this, surely it just means doing any kind of depiction of anything is suddenly going to become incredibly fraught.
Or even joking, right? Yeah. Like the idea with the Philadelphia thing, presumably it's a joke. If it was women doing it, it wouldn't be a joke. It wouldn't make any sense. To see a load of women incompetently looking after children wouldn't... It would just be odd, right? You have to have certain preconceptions in order for something to be funny. Jokes require a target. And in that instance, it happens to be men. In another instance, it could be women, although I don't think anyone would ever commission an advert that actually made fun of women. You're getting rid of admittedly quite weak humour, but it is humour nonetheless. And it ties in with the general assault on comedy. You know, if you can't have targets, if you can't make fun of people, there is no comedy left.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I just, you know, so there seems to me potentially a whole range of normal human activity that we can no longer portray. You know, I mean, there will be advertising executives sitting around for months working out, well, we've basically got the script here, but it's going to have to involve a human being displaying fecklessness. Right? That's a kind of key point of the narrative. So what sort of human being do we now need to cast in the starring role in order not to offend anybody on grounds of gender or race or whatever? So I agree, it's going to soak imagination and witticism completely out of the advertising sector. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I just scrapped the Advertising Standards Association and I just get rid of it. If people are typically advertising their products in a way that mortally offends large tranches of the population, they will pay the penalty by people boycotting their product.
Like Gillette.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes. That's exactly what happened. Yeah, I mean, quite. I mean, so, you know, either people are mortally offended or they're not. If they are mortally offended, the advertiser in question will take a pretty substantial financial hit. I think it's also a bit of an overhang of, you know, television being put in its own sort of pigeonhole. I mean, we now have so many different ways of consuming information that the idea that the television advertisement needs to be regulated in a particular way when people can market products however they want on Twitter, on social media, on websites, it's an artifact of when the only mass medium of communication to the public was television. That's no longer true, and the ASA is therefore an artifact regulator, I think.
Scrap the ASA, scrap PHE. That's a very good last orders place to end it. Mark, Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do give us a rating and a review with your podcast provider. And if you'd like to keep Spiked going and growing, why not give us a donation? Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Thanks so much and see you next time.